So if you could begin by reading the first two paragraphs of your book, and then we will be off and running.
Benjamin Franklin's sister Jane thought of her brother as her second self. He was the youngest of 10 sons. She was the youngest of 7 daughters. Benny and Jenny, they were called when they were little. No two people in their family were more alike. Their lives could hardly have been more different. He ran away from home when he was 17. She never left. He taught himself to write with wit and force and style. She never learned how to spell. The day he turned 21, he wrote her a letter. She was 14, beginning a correspondence that would last until his death 63 years later. He became a printer, a philosopher, and a statesman. She became a wife, a mother, and a widow. He signed the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, and the Constitution. She strained to form the letters of her name. He loved no one longer. She loved no one better. He wrote more letters to her than he wrote to anyone. All her life, she wrote back, letter after letter filled with news and recipes and gossip. And when she was truly sorely vexed, and only then, with her blistering opinions about politics.
That is a great setup to this story. Jill, why did you want to write a book about Jane Franklin? Because it's not immediately obvious that she would be a good subject for a biography.
Yeah, no, it's not obvious at all. And there's a whole genre of the women in the lives of famous men that I really, I have no interest in. It's a very difficult genre to appreciate, I think, in some ways. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a book I didn't want to write. Not for that, partly because it seemed sort of, it fell into a kind of a lot of traps about writing about women, but more because Jane's life is so poorly documented. And I started writing the book several different times and kept giving up because we know so much about Benjamin Franklin. He was, you know, considered in the 18th century the most famous American who had ever lived. Widely known. He was a polymath. He left thousands of letters, pages and pages of pamphlets and political tracts.
And he himself has been the subject of many biographies.
Everywhere, right, right. You know, he's on our money.
Right.
You don't want to write about the sister of someone who's on our money, I think is a rule of thumb. So, in all, and actually, he's also, he's quite compelling. He's quite a gravity well because he's so charming on the page. He's a sneaky, devious person in many ways, but he's really funny. He's delightful. He's warm. He's got a voice that is just, it's hard to put Franklin down. And then Jane is quite different. A lot of her life is just really just this yawning silence. So it's the asymmetry in the archive that was so difficult to think about because you didn't want to write. Another kind of hackneyed theme of writing about women is to kind of fetishize the silence. Oh, there's nothing left of their lives. It's so quiet. And I didn't want to do that either. So I kind of couldn't figure out how to break through all these different limitations. And yet, obviously, I was deeply compelled by her story.
Yeah. Well, what comes through in your book is how much affection there was between brother and sister. I mean, these were people who loved each other throughout their whole lives. And clearly, Jane remained very important in Benjamin's life, I mean, for the rest of their lives. And yet, when he wrote his own biography, his own autobiography, which is one of the most famous autobiographies in the history of this country, he never mentioned her.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, it also makes me a little sad because I think there's a pretty good chance she read it. He died in 1790, and it was published, you know, in a magazine and then in freestanding form shortly after his death. And she didn't die till 1794. She wasn't writing by then. She was quite old. And I don't know how well she could still read, but she would, I think she probably would have made every effort to read it. So it would have been hard, I think, for her to know. I mean, it wasn't an act of neglect or it isn't a testimony to a lack of affection for her. It's that Franklin's autobiography isn't nonfiction. You know, it's a fictional account in many ways, as many memoirs are. I mean, they straddle between the fiction and nonfictional forms. Autobiography as a genre had not been any way really defined. I mean, the word didn't exist when Franklin was writing the story of his own life. It wasn't even coined until 1797, and it was coined as a joke. It's like the word selfie, like it was a funny thing to say about how could someone write a book about themselves. So Franklin is as much relying on the conventions of the early novel as anything else. And he's writing the story of life, his life as an allegory. And in the way that he wanted that allegory to be most useful, he actually needed to leave pretty much everybody out. It's not just Jane. He didn't single her out for
because
illusion.
He wanted to present himself as the self-made
man. He's the
man.
Self-made man. I mean, he wanted to write a story about America, and he wanted to be an allegory for America. And for that, and he wanted, so it had to be about someone, you know, of humble, lowly origins from unexpected beginnings, who through industry and principle and integrity and industriousness rises, rebels against the forces of tyranny and arbitrary power and distinction, rises through the classes, becomes independent, politically independent, and prospers and does good in the world and is a beacon for all the world to see. So that story is not about, I ran away from home and I left behind my sister, who then married at 15 because she was so bereft. I never took care of my dying parents. I left them for my sister to take care of. I ran around the world and fathered bastards. I mean, like, there's a lot of other things that are left out of Franklin's life in the story that he tells, because he's really, it's a very didactic tale.
So is the thing that attracted you so much to the story the contrast between Benjamin and Franklin? I mean, here Benjamin is, you know, one of the most famous men of that era, as you say, on the money to this day. And she never had that chance, partly, maybe mainly, because she was an 18th century woman. That option wasn't even open to her to be on the public stage.
Yeah, well you know, there was this kind of classic 18th century thought experiment. What would happen if you had a boy and a girl, twins, and we could follow them through the course of their lives? What fate would befall them, given the different opportunities available to them? You know, Judith Sargent Murray, the American women's writer, writes an essay about this, speculating, trying to imagine. And at the age of two, it would look like this. And at the age of five, he would be sent, you know, he would learn to write and she would not.
And Virginia Woolf wrote an essay, right. You know, and speculating on, you know, what if Shakespeare had a brilliant sister? And, you know, in her scenario, she would have ended up running away, ruined, and killing herself.
Yeah. So it's a mainstay of beginning with the Enlightenment and then becomes part of feminist thought to imagine such a thing. What if Shakespeare had a sister? And it's a convention even in the 18th century that the woman must die, the girl must die if she exhibits the same kind of adventurousness, the venturesomeness. So, you know, Franklin ran away at 17, fathered a bastard, and that was fine. His life went on. Jane probably got pregnant at 15 and then had to marry and ended up living in poverty and having 12 children and burying 10 of them. Like, if the convention is the woman must die, like Judith Shakespeare, this fictional sister of William Shakespeare, has to die because Virginia Woolf couldn't imagine a life of the mind and the life of a mother. She couldn't reconcile those two things. The thing that attracted me about Jane is that Jane's not going to kill herself. I mean, she's a person who takes care of people. She is not a thought experiment. She's an actual person. But in a deeper way, I mean, actually, the feminist piece of it interests me a lot. But it's actually, for me, much more about the gap between the rich and the poor. We have, understandably, an urgent concern about the nature and persistence of inequality in the world today. And yet, we have a quite impoverished historical account of inequality, because the archives are so asymmetrical. And so because we know so much about people like Benjamin Franklin and so little about people like Jane. And I felt, as difficult as the project was in terms of handling the evidence problem, if we don't confront that evidence problem and try to deal with that asymmetry, we will never have a full account of the history of inequality. And how are we to understand what to do about inequality if we don't see it? If we kind of walk around with the idea in our minds that the only people who lived, say, for instance, in the 18th century were Benjamin Franklin and George Washington and John Adams, you know, then we have this cartoon history. And it's quite a dangerous and reactionary thing to have.
Mm-hmm. Tell me something about Jane Franklin's life. Now, she married young, 15, had lots of children, but it sounds like a hard life.
Yeah, so she was the youngest of 17 children, and she was a precocious girl in many ways. We know from what happens to her later and from later writings, that survive from later on in her life. Franklin ran away when he was 17. He had actually taught her to write, I think. It was quite unusual for a girl to know how to write as well as Jane knew, which was not very well, but much better than most American women at that time, as Franklin pointed out to her. He was quite interested in the idea that maybe girls ought to be educated, which was something that was being entertained, debated at the time. Daniel Defoe debated that. Franklin debated that question. And I think in his own kind of experimental way, Franklin decided he loved her more than anyone else in his family. I think he taught her how to write. And then he ran away when she was 11. And
he was what?
17.
6 years older.
Yeah. And she was left behind, and it was a little bit cruel and sort of leave somebody half educated. And I think she really floundered as she was quite a rebellious young person. Franklin writes to her when she's 14 and says, "I hear you've become a celebrated beauty." And he basically is writing her to say, "Watch out for your virginity," which is to say, "I also hear you are just as rebellious and saucy and provoking as I am," because Franklin had been quite similar as a teenager. It kind of the letter comes too late. By the age of 14, she's clearly something has happened with this next door neighbor, this poor kind of hapless older man who is a saddle maker. She marries him at the age of 15, which is illegal at the time. The average age for marriage in Massachusetts is 24. You can't get married without your parents' consent until you're 16. Her parents wouldn't have given consent unless she was pregnant, I don't think. It's just impossible. But she must have lost that baby. But then she has her first child when she's 17, and that child dies in infancy. And for years, for all those years, she's corresponding with Franklin. And we have Franklin's end of the correspondence writing, consoling her, condoling on her losses when her children die. But Jane's letters from those years are lost. But we do have this quite beautiful document. Jane kept it's sort of described in a library catalog as a diary, but she calls it a book of ages, where she chronicles the births of her children and then of their deaths and her prayers at their passing. So,
and you said she had 10 children who died?
Yeah, she had 12 children. Uh-huh. Several of them died in infancy. Most of them actually grew to adulthood, and then harder fates befell them. A couple of her daughters had many children, only to then die in childbirth or after childbirth. Two of her sons became violently insane and had to be locked up. Franklin made those arrangements for her. Jane lived a very long life, as did her brother. They were the only two children that lasted anywhere near as long as they did. And at the time of her death, 10 of her children had died. She thought 11 had, but one of them was just in a madhouse, and no one wanted her to know that he was still alive.
Now, one thing that comes through in some of the surviving letters that she wrote to her brother is her intelligence, for one thing, her personality. She was very opinionated, obviously very bright, and she could barely spell.
Yeah, which, you know, anybody who hadn't had formal education couldn't spell. It's a not unusual thing to not be able to spell, but it's interesting because it marks someone on the page. It's just like it speaks to you what their level of education is in a wholly different way. But she was an incredibly devoted reader. I mean, think about it. She's got this house. She's living with her aged parents, taking care of her parents, and she's got this house full of children, and she takes in boarders. And yet she's reading so that when she turns 21, Franklin sends her The Lady's Library, which is a 3-volume edition, like an anthology of writing for women. And that a copy of it survives. It's kind of amazing. I found it in an archive, her own copy that she's inscribed, Jane Meacham's book, given to her by her brother Benjamin Franklin. She also is pretty clear. She reads everything that Franklin ever has published. She asks him to send her everything that he has ever written and published, especially his pieces on politics and philosophy, which is kind of extraordinary. 18th century women are not known to be so fascinated by politics as Jane was. And if you think about that, I spent a lot of time reconstructing her library, like everything she ever read. But if you didn't even bother to do that and thought about someone who read everything that Benjamin Franklin wrote in the 18th century, everything that was published of Benjamin Franklin.
Now, there's a lot right
there. That's a lot right there. Like, that is actually an education in the entirety of the Enlightenment, right? I mean, she read her copy of Franklin's Experiments on Electricity survives with her name on it. She read everything that he wrote. That is an extraordinary education in political philosophy and in natural philosophy and in literature and literary style. But yet she reads a ton of other stuff too. She reads Swift and she reads Pope and she reads the newspapers. She's a very critical reader. There's poems she likes and poems she doesn't like, and she talks about the newspapers writers as all blusterers. She knows that a lot of, you know, exaggeration in the political newspapers.
How do you know all this? I mean, because I would think that would have been the trick of this project in a way, is to figure out what she did write and what her life was like, because it's not as if her life was well documented.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really, you just got to spend a lot of time with someone like that. I mean, a lot of it requires method, right? Like, there was a a stretch of time where I went through everything that I had about her and made this list of everything that every time she mentioned something that she had been reading or where she's clearly quoting something and I had to go find the source and see what she was. Oh, that was that's Pope's essay on man. That's so neat. I never knew she read that. You know, it's sort of just system is kind of required for this kind of research, right? Like we think of historical writing as so humanistic, and of course it is, but there's a lot of social science to it, right? So you kind of systematically have to go through everything, every scrap, you know, figure out where did that come from? Or her prayers, like what verses of the Bible are compelling to her? And to try to, you know, really reconstruct someone's worldview from what they read. Like she didn't travel in the world, you know, in the way that Franklin did. Of course, she wasn't off in London and off in Paris. She once went to Philadelphia. That's pretty much it. But she traveled in her mind. And so to try to make a map of the journey that she made over the course of her life was one task that I set for myself. Another was I just read and reread the letters. Like I actually just read them again and again and again and again because I kept thinking I must be missing something because they don't read like other letters that you're used to. Like if you read Franklin's letters, they're just so modern. Like he's you can imagine getting a letter from someone that works in some way like this. Jane's letter, you know, the spelling's terrible, the punctuation, punctuation is missing. There is none. There's a certain amount of just deciphering. So the temptation would be to transcribe it, right, in there and modernize it. But that's exactly not the right decision. Like what I tried to do was read them out loud because a writer of her level of literacy, she wasn't actually turning speech into prose, which is what Franklin did. That's what was called writing a polite letter, right, following the conventions of epistolary literature. She was actually just writing down what she would say if he were there. Huh. That's actually how that kind of literacy works. So, and that's how she understands reading. Like she says, you know, about reading his books, she says, I pick up your books of politics and philosophy, even though I've read them so many times now, because it's like hearing your voice, you know. And it's actually what's necessary to understand her is seeking out the intimacy that she is offering up, like actually receiving it.
Do you feel like you got to know her? Did you know who this person was?
I do. But, you know, it would be heuristic to think that I really did. You know, actually, biographers make their biggest mistakes when they think they really know somebody. I mean, you know, one of the more famous ones, you know, there's this, when Joseph Ellis's American Sphinx came out, wonderful biography of Jefferson. Won the National Book Award. He writes, I think it's in a preface or something, you know, he wants to address the question of whether Jefferson could possibly ever have fathered children with his slave Sally Hemings, who was the half-sister of his wife and apparently looked just like her. Jefferson's wife had died when Jefferson was only 36 and he had pledged never to remarry. And Ella says, you know, I know Jefferson very well. I'm also from Virginia. I also have red hair. I feel very close to him. And I just know he would never have been interested in sex again, you know, after the age of 36. Now,
and,
I don't know that.
He was wrong.
I don't know that about Thomas Jefferson, but he was wrong. And, you know, Ellis, you know, later acknowledged that he was wrong and has been very forthright about that. I don't mean to attack Joseph Ellis as being lacking. I just mean that we all are vulnerable to overconfidence, that we because the temptation is to think someone is just like you. And that there was a certain amount of insulation from that for me because Jane Franklin is not all like, I mean, there are ways in which I, you know, I feel close to her because I can understand how these things feel. And, you know, writing about a woman raising all these young children, it was important. I don't think someone who didn't have a house full of children that the way I did when I was writing this, I think it would have been much harder to understand that part of her life.
Was there anything in particular that you felt like you were never quite sure about? Was there any particular mystery that was part of Jane Franklin's life that has always eluded you?
Yeah, it was, first of all, very hard to understand her relationship to her husband because it seemed to me quite possible that he raped her when she was 15. If you became pregnant from a rape, you couldn't accuse your rapist of rape because people at the time believed you could not get pregnant unless you had had an orgasm. So you were unable to file criminal charges, and the best thing to do was probably to marry the person. I couldn't know that. She's just completely closed-mouthed about him, which is interesting. That was quite frustrating. It was he's really difficult to understand and get to know. I would say that's probably the single biggest mystery, and I was quite cautious about writing about it because I really don't know. And because there's no particular expectation for anything like the modern sense of of a romantic marriage in the 18th century. They wouldn't have understood that. There's an expectation for companionability and affection that seems surely lacking in their relationship, but it's a little bit, it would be so easy to make a mistake in assuming something about their relationship. You know, even now, you know, you every friend you talk to, every marriage is ineffable. You know, right. Like you see coming, I don't understand how those two can be together. You know, and it's always a mistake if you try to figure it out, like you try to puzzle it out. Why does she think that about it? Think about trying to do that over the course of, you know, someone who lived centuries ago and who never talked to. It's a big mistake. Another thing that was quite hard for me to figure out were her ideas about religion. It's helpful to me. I was raised a very devout Catholic, so a certain kind of piety and daily devotion I understand in her experience of her religion and its importance as solace to her during these times of grief and mourning. But she also rebels against it. And as someone who, you know, rebelled against my own religious upbringing, I think I had to be really careful not to overread into that and think that she had somehow crossed the bridge and joined Benjamin Franklin in a completely different world of ideas about religion. She'd never crossed that bridge.
Hmm. Now, one of the questions your book raises is, what should historians care about? What should they write about? I mean, you've already said that it should be more than just famous people, like her brother, Benjamin Franklin. I mean, the suggestion almost is that the life of someone like Jane Franklin is just as revealing as the life of a famous person from the 18th century.
Yeah, I did really intend. One of the times when I abandoned the book and then came back to it, I made a decision that I wanted the book itself to work as an allegory, to have the kind of ambition that Franklin's autobiography did, and to try to make an argument not just about this woman's small, obscure life, but about the writing of history. So it does, I do make that claim again and again and again. And from page one, like that's how the structure of the storytelling works, is to suggest that there's more to be learned here. I mean, one reason we don't have that historical account is that it's because of what happened in the 18th century, which is that the novel was born. And the conventions of novel writing and modern fiction were established in opposition to the emerging conventions of historical writing. And how those things work is that on one side is history that's about great men and involves facts and evidence. And on the other side is fiction, which is about ordinary people and their private lives and involves imagination and invention. And there's a gender divide there. And many 18th century novels are about women's lives in particular.
In fact, you have a great riff on another Jane Austen, who said at one point in one of her novels, I think, she sort of is dismissive of the kinds of histories that men wrote about popes and kings and wars. And the way you put it, in Austen, history written by men is, to women readers, fiction.
Yeah, that's a wonderful. I mean, Austen is hilarious on this point, and of course, brilliant. I mean, she's just brilliant. She writes this when she's a little girl. She writes a satire of one of these March of the Monarchs histories of England. It's very, very funny. And her point is, you know, this is all invention. Historical writing histories are invention because look at everything that they miss. I mean, how could an account of England that's only about its kings actually really be considered truth? Right? That's Jane Austen's point. That's the whole point of 18th century fiction and 19th century fiction, too. And it's a very well elaborated premise. It's not just people say this all the time. You know, fiction writers say our work is truth. What historians write is lies. And it's a quite interesting debate. And, you know, lives just don't sort out on either side of that divide. You know, it's not just that Benjamin Franklin belongs to the world of historical writing and Jane belongs to the world of fiction. I mean, I thought for a while writing a novel about her, and then I decided not to, because what I wanted to call attention to were the consequences of that divide. Because when we don't have a life like Jane's in her historical account, I mean, think about, like, you know, what it means. I was thinking about when Franklin is going to be sequestered for the Constitutional Convention in 1787, she writes him a letter and she says, you know, I hear you gentlemen in Philadelphia are about to establish a new body of laws. And I just would like you to remember that one good thing to do would be to beat your swords into plowshares. She is opposed to war. She has always been concerned about guns. Now, I guess I would say it would be useful if we knew that,
Right. I mean, we know a lot about what the delegates to the Constitutional Convention felt about a standing army and about matters of armament. We know even what people who debated in the ratifying conventions think. When we take all of those people, which are the only people that inform our judicial debate about constitutional debate about the nature of, military authority, the bearing of arms, you're talking like 400, 500 people. Yeah. And they're all very similar to one another. It's a very narrow slice of a population. I think there are consequences to writing private lives of women as fiction and public lives of men as history, because we don't live that way. They didn't live that way either.
I want to ask you a little bit more about your own approach to history. You've been described as someone who writes microhistory, taking the particulars of, let's say, a person's life, usually not a famous person, and then using those episodes to tell us about the larger world. It's sort of the opposite of the old sort of great man view mm-hmm. of history. Is that a fair description of what you do?
Microhistory has a long and distinguished tradition, and some of my favorite works of history are often classed within it. You know, the work of Natalie Zeman Davis, remember Return of mm-hmm. Martin Guerre, yep. or the work, some of the really just luminous work of Robert Darnton, for instance. There are wonderful works that are understood as microhistory. I'm not sure how at this point those scholars would feel about that term. The thing that that maybe troubles me a little bit about it, especially in writing about women, it's a little bit like it conjures up maybe for someone who doesn't know the scholarship on which it rests, right, which is this Sinal school of historical writing that's about the really rigorous social history and demographic reconstitution, that it almost seems like it might be twee. Hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like the micro, like, oh, it's tiny. It's about this girl. You know, and I think that there's such a temptation in the public realm to box up these lives and say, oh, yes, well, you know, it was, it's just another of these, you know, Shakespeare's sister, Lincoln's wife kind of things. And it's that concerns me because the microhistorical is just as likely to be an epic tale, right, of great analytical force, of significant scholarly contribution. I mean, think about what The Return of Martin Guerre tells us about that entire world. It's, you know, so I think that I love that work. I think that I worry a little bit about the term itself.
Now, one other thing that I'm curious about is how you think about the history that you write in comparison with the journalism you write, because you were also a staff writer for The New Yorker, and there would seem to be a fair amount of overlap. I mean, obviously, books are much longer than a New Yorker piece, but is it a different kind of thing that you're doing? Are they basically sort of the same?
I think they contribute one to another. I mean, I think I brought to The New Yorker some sensibility I had established as a historian about how to write about the past, and then also maybe how to think about the relationship between the past and the present and how our ideas about things change over time, which is a longstanding interest of mine. So that I think is maybe a good fit for a journalistic beat where, you know, a magazine reader is not necessarily interested in the past for its own sake, but wants to have some connection made to the world in which we live now. That's something that I've always been interested in, and that ties together both. I think what I've brought from the world of writing for The New Yorker to the back into the scholarship is a different sensibility about literary nonfiction. Because what I try to do in The New Yorker essays is really use the conventions of the short story to make a historical argument. And that's really hard. It's incredibly fun. It's like a cryptic crossword puzzle or something. Like, you actually have to, how could I do that? Like, I have this argument to make about, you know, the abolition of debtor's prison. It's a little piece I wrote a few years ago. There's a really interesting scholarship about how debtor's prison comes to be abolished in the United States long before it's abolished in England. Why would that be? And why even was there debtor's prison in the first place? Like, the reader wants to know. I have an argument I want to make, and it has implications for how we understand debt today. And so it's a big and fairly intricate argument. But I'm writing for a magazine that publishes, you know, the best literary nonfiction and fiction in the world, and has this incredible tradition of a certain form of storytelling. So I have to think about those conventions. And I somehow have to find a story in the archives that can help me to make the argument I want to make. And it,
so that's fascinating. So you want to use the conventions of the fictional short story. So you sort of have to find the right historical story to fit that convention. To illustrate a larger point.
So it's all about the finding of the story. I mean, in the case of that, I wrote this essay years ago called IOU. This is what came out of this, and it begins with the story of this guy, John Pintard, who went to debtor's prison in New York and ended up founding the New York Historical Society. But he was a good fit for the story for a lot of reasons, but it's a tricky thing to do. But in any case, it has made me far more sensitive to. I mean, it's an apprenticeship. Like, I'm working on trying to figure out how to do this, to how to deliver an argument within the storytelling itself. That's the trick. Like, a story without an argument is antiquarianism in historical writing, and an argument without a story is pedantry. So, I mean, you know, at the extremes, right? Like, there's a lot of different ways to skin this cat. But the trick then is to have a story that makes an argument, and an argument that takes the shape of a story. And doing that for, you know, the time I've had the luck to be able to do this in these essays for The New Yorker, I've just learned a ton. So I think that, if you were looking for it, you would see that in this book about Jane Franklin, where I am actually attempting to deliver a quite ambitious argument about the writing of history by telling you a story about this woman you've never heard of before and whose life was quite ordinary.
Well, it also strikes me that there are a lot of parallels between what we would call immersion journalism. I mean, someone who just a journalist who wants to tell a real life story, but, you know, spends a lot of time with her subjects and then weaves a compelling story out of it. Between that and a good history, I mean, you're sort of doing something similar, except for you're probably not dealing with living people.
Yeah, no, I do. I do think it's similar, and I find that work so inspiring. Like, I just love to read that stuff, right? I love to see. I feel so grateful for the education that a piece like that offers to a reader. You know, that piece of journalism where you are taken to a place that you've never been to and are never going to go to, and you are shown a world that does not at first appear to intersect with your own, but it is revealed to you what meaning the people who live in that world make of it by someone who is a keen discerner, and which in the end tells you more about the world in which you live by analogy, by implication, by distinction, by comparison, or simply by the sheer artfulness of the thing itself. You know, it's like the way, you know, you read a poem that captivates and compels you. You just feel like you would take a bullet for that poet. You know, at that moment when you were brought to that place of just the full beauty of being human and the company of the mind of someone who perceives in that way. I just adore them. I swoon for those moments. So I take incredible inspiration from that. And I do wish that there were more. I kind of just like, well, couldn't history be that way sometimes? Like, does it have to be kind of like, there's a lot of like jingoistic popular history and it's like rah, rah, whatever. And then there's other incredibly profound and important moving scholarship that I care about deeply. But I just wish there could be a little bit more poetry in the past.
Well, thank you so much. And I have to say, there's a lot of poetry in your book, so it's a pleasure.
Thank you.